This is Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, and all things strange.
This is Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, and I'm at Strange Harbor. And this is where you need to be. Keep listening, because it's happening right here.
This pilot, though, who flew Barack Obama during his 2008 presidential campaign, says UFOs are real, and he's seen one firsthand.
An unidentified object seen over the sky above the Rosedale area.
The shot today video that's got all of Texas talking, probably the whole country, from iReporter, who shot this on a cell phone near Stephenville, Texas. The UFO, according to witnesses, and the witnesses include local police and other public figures.
When several dozen residents looked up and saw a UFO more than once.
Three very mysterious shiny lights over Breckenridge have police and residents puzzled.
Tonight we have never before seen videotape of UFOs over Colorado.
If you noticed strange lights in the sky over the weekend, you aren't alone. KCTV5's Alan Shope went to Lee's Summit to get to the bottom of more than a dozen UFO sightings.
Never before seen footage of UFO sightings this year being shown at a conference in Pontefract.
Local police never definitively said who's to blame. Locals say it has to be something out of this world.
I'm taking a random picture, zoomed in, and there it was. There was a UFO.
Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange.
Hey, this is Derek Randles with the Olympic Project, and you're listening to Strange Harbor.
Don't miss a single episode because strange things are going to happen.
This is Strange Harbor.
And another exciting episode of Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, we talk about UFOs and Sasquatch, conspiracy, ghosts, near-death experience, so much more. I am Johnny Manson, and she is MUFON investigator Sherita Seuss.
Keeping it real with UFOs.
Our guest today, MUFON State Section Director Kathleen Weyer. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Johnny. Hey, Sherita. How's it going there?
Oh, it's great. It's raining meows and bow-wows out here.
Well, that would be our weather here because we're in the convergence zone in the Olympia area, and it tends to get pretty spooky foggy here, that's for sure.
Ooh.
And I'm lucky that I found a chunk of property because outside the city. Of course, the city's well known now because it was in the Borat movie, the latest Borat movie. I don't know if you saw that.
Oh my gosh.
It was kind of like, wait a minute, that's here in Olympia. Wow.
Yeah, it gets to be a real small world when you got Borat in it, huh?
Yeah.
So we have the MUFON connection today, huh?
That's right.
Now, not only state section director, you're a member of other parts of MUFON?
I not only do field investigations, it's a kind of a volunteer organization. Let's get that one straight to begin with. And there's a lot of work that's involved with it, as Sheree can attest to. It takes a while to be in that official section director mode. I started when belonged to MUFON in 2014. And then just recently, probably in the last 4 years, have moved up to the section director position. So I was a field investigator and section director. Section director basically means different sections of the county, because that's the way that MUFON will put together their caseloads. If you put in a report on the main site, which is in Irvine, California, and then they go through it, they send it to the state director, like here would be Maureen Morgan, and then it goes to the state chief investigator, which is Dan Mims, and then Dan parses it out to wherever you are located geographically, so that when you get a call, depending on what level it is, you'll be able to speak with your witness, and if they say, hey, is that with Alba the Ocean Shores area, which used to be mine and now it's Cherie's, and you can relate to that witness, so it's easier to talk to them.
Well, I want to thank you for the case that you kicked down to me. That's a real interesting one for me.
Good.
Fireballs.
Good.
From the sky.
Fireballs, what?
Yeah, yeah. That's a real thing. If you go to the American Meteor Society, you can find fireballs falling from the sky. And that's kind of what I have, and so I'm investigating it right now.
That was just yesterday, so, I mean, that's a real recent thing.
Yeah.
And our areas are pretty active as far as the state statistics. Ours used to be floated right around number 3. And unfortunately, in the last, 6 months or so, a lot of the calls and reports have gone down a bit. So this last month, we're at about 13. So
yeah.
The top 3 are California, New York, and Texas.
Yeah, they got their eyes up in the sky, huh?
Yeah, it's clear. It's clear in those areas.
So since you've been working since 2014 for MUFON, you must have had some interesting cases.
Oh, yeah. The work is interesting. The cases are interesting. But some of the things that you have to be careful of is we do have a pretty standard process of if someone sends you something, you're in that area where you understand the geographical area, and you can call them and they can say, here's one of mine that is one of my favorites. Actually, it was in Onalaska area by Centralia, and it's a historical case, but I think why I found it fascinating is because I really related to the person that was talking about the case, and that's one thing that you can tell if someone is trying to hoax you or if they're not quite sure what they've seen. This person was sure.
Wow.
And they made the noises, and you know, they painted the story beautifully.
Uh-huh.
So I was intrigued, and I had this kind of schizophrenic thing going on in my head saying, okay, stop listening to the story, but you know, was this a this or was this that or was it this, and not saying interrupting that person so they could continue with their story.
Well, that's
so.
Go ahead.
I'll paraphrase it for you.
Great.
He was probably 20 years old, and he was working with a kind of a father figure, and they worked as at a school basically, and they were driving back and forth to work. The drive that they'd made time and time and time again, and at that point in time, it was late in the evening. Almost dusk, and you know how it stays pretty light here in the summertime, so around June 17th or so in 1981. And as they were coming around, they were actually driving down Jackson Highway, going to witness one's parents' house so he could do laundry, and that was something that I had to laugh about because that's what my son does too. And the older witness, the father figure, said, sure, you know, I'll drop you off, and you can drive the truck. And so that's what he did. And they got to the crossroads of Jackson Highway and State Route 508. And as they started to turn that corner there, they saw this out of the corner of their eye, they saw something that just didn't have any place in their normal drive. And I said, well, what'd you see? And he said, well, I saw in the silhouettes of the trees there, and the place is like farm community, except for one group of trees.
Uh-huh.
And as he's talking, I'm going through Google Earth, right, and I'm looking to see, now is this really what he's seeing? And it was right on. It was just like a fascinating story. He said, I saw a UFO that was 85 feet long, and it had just appeared. It was floating 50 feet off the ground.
Ooh.
And he said, I almost drove off the road. So we pulled over, and we had to get out of the truck because we were totally in shock. I said, yeah, I probably would be too. and I said, so what did you do? And he goes, well, we just leaned up against the truck and watched it for a while because you have all these things going through your head, like, am I really seeing this? Is this really real? Do I, you know, what? And I thought, yeah, that makes sense. With all our bike training, we've had that before. And I said, he goes, it was only 50 feet away, and we watched it for 5 minutes. And I said, well, how did it leave? Did you hear anything? Was there any noise? What was it made of? And he said, no, no noise, no propulsion systems I could see. And the lights underneath the craft were going bing, 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 all over the place, not in a rhythm. And he said, then it's slow. I said, how did it leave? He goes, it slowly floated across towards the trees, and it silhouetted itself towards the trees, and then made a little jerk, and then disappeared. I was just blown away. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. I've driven that area. And he had talked to me about it. He goes, well, you know where that is? Do you know where that is? I'm like, yeah, I do. And he goes, I'm down in Seaside, California right now, and it took me 30 years to call you. I'm like, really? And he said, yeah. I said, why did you wait so long? He goes, well, you know, I mean, it's a tinfoil hat sort of thing. And I said, yeah, I get that. I wish they wouldn't do that, because there's probably a lot more people that have seen things that have not reported things.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah. It was an amazing story. And it didn't stop there. What he said, too, was, now, I'll find my friend here, that's the father figure, the second witness. And he goes, I'll give you his number. Just a minute. So he's looking through his book, his, you know, little black book or his phone or whatever it was. And he goes, I think he's moved down to California, and I got a couple numbers here. I'm not sure which one's right. So I'm sure that was a clue to me that they hadn't coordinated the story. And I thought, great, we can verify this. He goes, well, call him, because I haven't talked to him in a while, and he'll tell you the same thing. I said, okay. So I called him, and it was a cold call, and he answered the phone and said, you know, and I said, hey, do you know this person? And he goes, yeah. And he goes, we kind of bonded over that. I thought, yeah, we would bond over something like that.
Oh, yeah.
And wow. he told me the exact same story, except that he said it didn't do the little jerk thing, but he was quite a bit older, and he might have just missed that. And,
sure.
He said it just flew off towards the trees, and at a real slow pace, and then just faded away in the silhouette because it was dark. So that was really the only thing. That was a pretty amazing story, and I was thrilled about it just because it was one of the first ones that I'd had on my own.
Oh.
So I didn't have a mentor or anything, you know. Wow, okay, cool.
Yeah, MUFON definitely puts you in the thick of it pretty soon after you get done with the university.
Right. Oh, that's tough, that MUFON university. That's tough. Yeah.
Well, I'm interested in myself into the ERT, but what is the difference between a field investigator that I've just become and an experienced or research team member, an ERT?
We get that question quite a bit, and there's definitely, I think the easiest way to explain that is, the ERT, which is Experienced or Research Team, is more therapeutic or, you know, woo kind of people that have actually been either seen an alien, an ET, or gotten messages from them, or have been taken up into a craft. So they don't have the rigors that the regular field investigator has to go through. There's a lot of boxes, checks and balances as far as the case management system. Hold on a second, I've got to take a drink.
Yeah, it really interests me because I have dreams about alien and different alien species and the worlds they live in.
Yeah, you could very well have had some sort of experience. A lot of them have had, the cases that I've received, people, we get this, something that gets sent out by Kathleen Martin, who's the the head of that, and she's actually Betty and Barney Hill's niece. So that's a fascinating story in itself. But that group will, we go through different things where we have to put an application in, you know, explain what kind of things can you bring to this group, and then it goes to the state director, and she makes that recommendation, and then you fill out a bio and a form, and it's put in a different section of the MUFON organization. And if somebody is looking for someone just to talk to, not necessarily fill out a report, but there is a report for the ERT group, but it's real different than the field investigator stuff.
So
they questions like, have you had missing time? Have you had interesting dreams, similar to what you're talking about? Do you crave salt? Do you have anything on your body that could potentially be an implant? Have you ever taken a UV light and put it on where you're, maybe you have some bruises or something like that? And, you know, all of us fall down now and again or bump into something.
Oh, yeah.
And if you take the UV light and shine it on your skin, supposedly an ET, if you actually have some sort of alien like experience, will leave something on your skin that glows, sort of like black light glowing.
We've had Daryl Sims, the alien hunter, in the studio numerous times, and he's supposedly the one who discovered what they're calling alien fluorescence.
The fluorescence, in my opinion, the best way to describe it to your audience is that when they touch you, if they touch you physically, like hold your arm or lead you down the hallway or whatever it is they're doing, it will leave a fluorescent trace. It's like an alien sweat is the best way to describe it, I guess.
Okay.
It will penetrate your skin subdermally on contact. You can't go get a magic marker and paint it on you and it work. It won't work. This stuff will penetrate your skin subdermally on contact. You can't get it off. It'll finally be absorbed. Usually within 24 hours it's gone. I have seen it in rare cases last as long as 2 weeks, but that's very rare.
Very strange stuff.
So some kind of a chemical influence that they leave behind.
That's the theory.
I'll be darned.
So, as you know, we've got to put together some kinds of kits, and that's what I've got is a black light flashlight, just in case.
Wow, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, is there room in MUFON here in Washington for new investigators, field investigators?
As far as field investigators, we could always use field investigators, and that's part of our work is trying to find other people that are interested in that. They just need to know that it's fun, but it's work. So there are special kinds of things that you need to do as far as timelines on the cases. You have 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours to call your witness. And before you call your witness, you need to look at the information that you receive on the report so that you're familiar with the case, so you can be doing similar to what I did on the case that I told you. You can be looking at that stuff as they're talking and get a sense for whether this is what it is.
What brought you to become a MUFON member?
As a kid, I've always been interested in the sciences and rocks and Egypt and archaeology. And then I start questioning as you get a little older, why am I so interested in this? You know, what is it in my background? Is it the same thing as people do when they're looking for, you know, ancestry kind of information? Well, mine was intense. My father died when he was 48, and I was in my early 20s, and I was into all kinds of different Egyptology kind of stuff.
Huh.
And I was taken to Egypt by my grandfather. Well, I don't know, we traveled over there. And when I came back, I'm like, okay, I saw the westernized Egypt.
Uh-huh.
What I want to see is real Egypt.
Uh-huh.
And as, you know, a 20-year-old, you know, Khomeini stuff was going on, and, you know, they weren't very happy with it. But I flew by myself across back to Egypt, met somebody there that I had been, that was a native, and they picked me up, and I spent a bunch of time down in the Valley of Kings, and we drove around, and just had a good time. You know, kind of stupid kid stuff, but I was really, really interested in all that archaeological stuff. I've done a lot of traveling, and I guess part of what's interesting, too, is one of the things that I've gotten through learning about the cases for CERT members is that oftentimes they'll see things that are screen memories. In other words, things are so frightening that they put things into their mind to keep them from thinking that they've actually had an experience. One of those things, and this is probably my most one of my most recent cases, an owl. This person had experiences like when they were 18 months old, and they could remember things. They had a really, really incredible memory.
Huh.
And his mom would say, "How do you remember that?" He goes, "Well, my imaginary friend told me." And she said, "What's his name?" And she said, "His name's Hootie."
Oh.
That's a cute name. So as they're looking at the animal book, you know, the ABC book where you learn your ABCs, so they get to the O, and it's an owl. And he goes, "There's Hootie. That's my imaginary friend."
Oh, my gosh.
So that's what a screen memory is. And I think that some of us have had experiences where we don't really remember that stuff. Like, I've had a lot of lucid dreams, too. And then I have odd experience in the land that I'm on right now with owls. Talking to Johnny just a little bit earlier about how, you know, the leaves are all over, and there's different owls around here. And Alita, who's another MUFON member, and I told her about how pretty it was and that we had all kinds of owls. She said, "Uh-oh." I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, it could be a good thing or a bad thing." I said, "What do you mean?" So she was the one that turned me on to that. But there's small barred owls, or large barred owls here, and small spotted owls, which I'm sure you're pretty familiar with in the Grace Harbor area.
Uh-huh.
That particular owl is endangered, so they stopped cutting old growth. I'm sure it was tough on families. But the barred owl will caterwaul like a monkey. It's very strange.
You sent me a video, and I heard it, and they sound just like a monkey.
Just like a monkey. And so I'm laying in bed, and I'm hearing this, you know, all this weird noise. And I got up, and I walked out, and there was a whole mess of them in the tree. I mean, more than one.
Gosh.
There must have been 15 of them or something.
There are different individuals in the paranormal and for UFOs that state that owls are a common animal for people to have seen that have had experiences with aliens.
Right.
Especially
right.
Children, because they're so warm and fuzzy towards an owl, and maybe not so much toward a gray alien. So, yeah, this tracks. Exactly.
It does, doesn't it?
It really does. It kind of gives you the goosies a little, but so you really want to listen in on what people are telling you about seeing an owl or having some kind of a altercation or talking even to an owl like a friend. So, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well,
it was pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Pretty fascinating.
Kathleen has had some experience with Sasquatch here in Washington State. We're going to talk about that coming up on Strange Harbor.
You're listening to Strange Harbor. Ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor. Be strange.
Welcome to Strange Harbor. If you've had an out-of-the-ordinary experience, then come to strangeharbor.net and let us know what it is.
It's Strange Harbor, where we talk about the weird, and our guest today, Kathleen Wire of MUFON.
You also have interest and have had some experience with Sasquatch.
I have, and I was saying to Johnny how much I enjoyed his conferences, because I think originally I was out in the woods a lot and I'd work with Dan Hall. Sometimes he's another MUFON guy. And he has a group that would go out. It's disbanded now, but it would go out and look for ghosts and Sasquatch And a couple of times we would get together, having our interest peaked, and we'd go up to the Lummi Reservation up north, and it's pretty much off limits to most people, unless you have acquaintance with a tribal member. Anyway, Sherry and Dan and I would drive around late at night on the Indian reservation in a hearse.
Oh.
And yeah, and that's weird to begin with, right? And
most
percent why. Well, she worked for the reservation as a chemical dependency person, you know, to try and help people out and get off of drugs and whatnot.
Sure.
Or alcohol, any of that. And so you get that, again, tinfoil hat thing. She had seen some of the tribal members, you know, think they're forest people, but she had actually seen some around there peeking. You know, they're great at hide and seek. But she also had said, and I don't know if I totally believe her, the woo factor. I'm more of a science person. I go along with, like, maybe what Jeff Meldrum has to say. But we would drive around these back areas looking for Sasquatch. We had rocks in the back seat, you know, so we clap. We ended up driving down one of the roads really late. It was probably 3 in the morning at this point in time. And we were roaming. We were looking. We stopped, and I looked out in the field, and she said, I've seen things out in this field. Let's watch for a while. I said, okay. Then Dan was behind me, and it wasn't more than a few minutes, and all of a sudden this cop drove up behind us. I thought, uh-oh. And we rolled down the window. Sherry rolled down the window, and he said, oh, hi, Sherry. What you doing? You know, he knew her. And she goes, well, I'm out watching for ghosts and Sasquatch. I thought, oh, my God, what are you doing? He goes, yeah, I've seen them before, too. I thought, what? My head just kind of exploded. But and then he left, and we kept watching, and it wasn't much longer after that that this kind of ectoplasma, fog-like mist, even though, you know, you're used to seeing that in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
But this thing moved so quickly that I actually moved back. We had the window open, too. I actually moved away from the window and sat back like I was trying to get away from something coming into the car. I mean, that was my immediate reaction to
Interesting.
It.
Interesting.
So even knowing all these things, it scared me. And Dan behind me said, did you see something, Kathy? I said, oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. And I tried explaining it to him, and then I turned to Sherry, and I said, did you see that? Because she was pretty psychic, too. And she said, yeah, I saw it. I didn't know if anybody else did. But yes, I did. It scared me.
Yeah.
That was one adventure up there. The second one was we had gone up there again, and there was a group of people that had been gifting Sasquatches, and so we wanted to see what that was about. And they had put apples and whatnot in bags, plastic bags, tied them up real tight because that way you know, put them up in a tree like they tell you to do to keep bears away.
Oh,
and they would pack and they would find that there had been something taken out of there and maybe something else that had been left, like it was a gift. This was something that they had happen to them. It didn't happen while we were there.
They thanked you
Pardon
for
me?
The food? You were thanked for the
yes.
food?
And I said, did you see them? And she said, well, you know, they're shy, and they like to wait until you leave. She goes, so we're driving away. And I looked in the rearview mirror, and I saw it cross the road. I'm
oh
like, wow,
oh
that's
my
pretty
goodness.
Cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the group of us, I think there was 4 or 5 of us that were in the group, they said, you want to see where they have a little educational center for their kids? And I'm thinking,
huh?
Yeah, sure. And so we go up, and she said, you know, Sherry goes, I don't want to go back there. It's really creepy. There's something wrong with that area. And then Dan said the same thing. And so they just kind of talked by the car. But this other gal and I walked back into an area that, you know, in the super forested. There's lots of slough. You know how this forest is? It's this really rainforest area, and it's all full of stuff. This area had nothing on the ground. It was as if it had been cleared or radiated or something. The only thing that was around the perimeter was like a slough, a little bit of slough. And what they said was that this was where they trained the baby Sasquatches to build those cross nests and areas where they have don't go this way. So you have trees that fold in X's, or you have nests that are made out of certain things, or you have it interwoven with blackberry vines and whatnot.
Oh, I see.
In here, they had blackberry vines that were leaned up against a tree. And I don't know, you guys know about blackberry vines. You can't hardly pull them. They're tough. And you can't, you'd have to cut them to get them out or get a goat or something. They take these vines, and I don't think this was a native blackberry. I think just wasn't the Himalaya either. It was almost like a black cap or something, and they're pretty long and straight. But these ones were pulled, broken, and they were probably as little smaller than my wrist. I mean, that's how wide around they were. They had these huge thorns on them, and they were all leaning up around these different trees, like kids in a preschool where they would put away their toys. So they had them sitting in certain areas. Anyway, that was the theory for this particular place.
Interesting.
And I could see why they thought that. It was very interesting.
Well, it looked manipulated. I mean, you look at it from a scientific view, it was actually manipulated for a purpose.
Yes. And not by a human being.
I happen to be a member of the Olympic Project, and co-founder Derek Randles was contacted by a timber surveyor about these nests discovered while out surveying. Here's Olympic Project Corps member Shane Corson to give you a little more detail.
This timber surveyor came across these ground nests, and they were really perplexing to him. In his 25-plus years, he had never seen anything like these ground nests. They're oval in shape. They're constructed out of huckleberry. They're large. And so he got a little weirded out. He gets a hold of Derek and James Million of the Olympic Project, come out with this timber surveyor as well as a couple of DNR guys. And between all their years in the woods and all their experience, they had never seen anything like these ground nests. The ground nests range in size from about 3 feet across to about 8 to 9 feet across, over a foot in depth, completely made out of huckleberry, constructed in a fashion. And the huckleberry breaks in this area range from like 3/4 of an inch to 2 inches or more. Something with an opposable thumb had to break these branches, these huckleberry branches, apart and formulate this nest. Now, we brought in Dr. Jeff Meldrum out of Idaho State University out there. We've had anthropologists out there. We've had zookeepers out in this area, and they're all enthralled with these ground nests, and they say they're very primate-like. We have taken hair samples from these nests, and they fit the primate's hair, also other unknown hair from around the states they've been compared to. They look very primate-like. They kind of fit with what we call like the Sasquatch hair. Since 2016, a group of us have been looking for new nests. We came across some possibly older nests, 3 to 4 years older than the original nest site, the end of February, and we walked in on something actually in the process of making one of these nests. Pretty freaky experience just because this thing was massive.
And the last time we spoke to Derek Randles.
Where we found these nests is pretty unique. It's on isolated, remote finger ridges, western, southwestern facing ridge, within 100-yard proximity to a viable salmon creek. Impenetrable vegetation for protection, miles behind locked gates with no human presence. I can't believe we found 21 of these beds.
Didn't they find rocks? It was like at an area where they could look out over the valley. And it was
right.
So they checked and see if somebody was coming up. And didn't they have rocks that were sort of up at the top, either to bang together or to throw at people?
Right. There were some rocks found there that were just really out of place, and it looked like they'd been struck together. And they were strategically placed, these nests, almost like they were protecting something in the middle.
That was one of my favorite conferences.
Well, thank you. Here's a little bit more from Shane about more nests being discovered.
There's been other nests found, historically speaking, never this many. I mean, we're up to 23 nests now, basically. Going back to 1967, the Patterson-Gimlin film, a lot of people don't know that Lyle Lafferty was a timber cruiser. He worked for the timber company down there in Bluff Creek, and he came across a nest in 1967 on an area called Scorpion Creek. Well, Scorpion Creek feeds into Bluff Creek, and it's a stone's throw away from the Patterson-Gimlin film. Well, of course, Patty, if you look at Patty, she's a female. A lot of people speculate that she was either had birth or was about to give birth just based on her girth and some other features. I often think these nests were coming across, especially up up here, and now maybe every 4 years, maybe there's a birthing cycle, and the different size nests, the bush nests, maybe we're dealing with a birthing or some sort of nursery scenario. Now, getting to the huckleberry leaves, it's only in certain areas, and it's also medicinal. It's got medicinal purposes. Birthing, for a mother that gives birth, it gives her strength. You know, they'll give it to a human with a mixture of sugar, and it's like a rehabilitation sort of thing. So I was thinking, all these huckleberry leaves have been snapped off, in some cases, or peeled off or plucked off, in some cases, in piles. If a Sasquatch gave birth, what if it just ate a ton of these leaves,
yeah,
you know, to get regain strength in an area where you already have tons of huckleberry, salmonberry, salalberry, Oregon grape, you got all the ungulates in this area, and you have seasonal salmon runs that are ridiculous. What a setup. That's interesting.
It was fun to talk to Cliff and some of the other folks that were there. Met at the person that had done the Patty film, the Patty
Gimlin. Oh, Bob Gimlin. Yeah.
Bob. Nice guy.
Oh,
nice
yeah.
Guy.
He's great. Yeah. He's a great guy. What I don't get about, like, some of these people that say, oh, he's lying and blah, 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 or the people that say that I was in the Patty suit, it was me, and this is how we did it. We took football shoulder pads and did this and this. Well, once we had technology good enough to stabilize it, you see breasts in the footage. Nobody mentioned that. You know? Right. If that was you, how come you didn't say anything about making the boobs? Right? You would think that.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you put a couple cantaloupes and, you know, pantyhose and they swung around. But nothing until we're able to stabilize it. And then you see him perfectly clear. And Meldrum, he's studied that original film so much. You can see, like, the muscles tense up in her legs. I mean, how are you going to fake that? Disney, they were, like, the best at making costumes back then. I think they were doing Planet of the Apes at about that time. And they're, like, going, we didn't do it. And if this is a costume, we'll hire that guy because we would want to do it like that, you know?
Wow.
But it's all a hoax. Just some bored rednecks with shoulder pads.
Why do people have so much difficulty believing in the strange and unusual?
Well, you look at the Bible, and I'm not saying that that's good or bad, but there are a lot of things in there that are like, I'm sorry, what did you say? Right?
So, lots of things.
You know the potholes area? Those big potholes in the east of Washington, the dry falls and the basalt columns, all that stuff on the east side, Columbia River area. Well, all of that is, to me, it's pretty fascinating. And part of that, the reason why all that was together was that that was all lake. And at one point there was an ice dam that, from the ice age, that built up there, and it's one of the last ice sheets, it broke. And you can imagine a dam holding all that water coming down the canyon.
Ooh.
At 80 miles an hour or so.
Wow.
And just scouring out all that basalt lava flow, and that's what made those holes and the falls, and it did it more than one time. So that was pretty interesting, too.
Wasn't Graham Hancock and Randall Carlson studying over there about that?
Yeah.
We did a fantastic research trip across the Channel Scablands of Washington State, which Randall has been walking the walk on for decades, and he just showed me the absolute irrefutable evidence of cataclysmic flooding in that area. And North America was the epicenter of a global cataclysm between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And when you see it through Randall's eyes, you get it immediately.
Hancock is one of my favorite people. He did that ancient archaeological book, Forbidden Archaeology. And that's what got me really moving in towards stuff like that, too. You could look in that book, and there'd be things like, surrounded in rock, there was a butt plug in rock, really old one. And I saw that picture, and I went,
what is a spark plug doing in a rock? Ignatius rock?
It was like a volcanic.
Oh,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, it was very strange. It piqued my interest. And then, of course, you can find that in all kinds of petroglyphs. And you can see, and it's, you know, people sometimes say, well, yeah, you know, people see things in clouds. They see, there's a word for it, but I don't recall it. It's periodalia or something like that.
Yeah, it's where you see faces. Our mind creates faces for our safety in all kinds of objects, like the clouds.
Jesus in the right?
Yeah, Jesus in the toast. So you have a real passion for rock art and petroglyphs. So what do you do with all these rocks and minerals that you collect?
Collected things from Doug Opal. There's an opal mine that's over actually in Idaho. It's called the Peacock Opal Mine. They're not like the Australian opals. They tend to be a little soft stone, and you need to keep them in oil for a little bit. And we picked up, my husband and I picked up sunstone. So we did some mining over in Oregon around Plush area. And all those are semi-precious. And so what I've done with all the rocks, I have buckets of carnelians and rocks out by the front door. It's sort of like I'm a hoarder for rocks. And so I take them, and I have a place in Prineville, not too far from a central or high desert, and I have a lot of lapidary equipment down there. But up here, I take and do my wire wrapping.
Oh.
So, I mean, you know, you got to know that I'm into rocks and minerals if you buy someplace that's in the middle of the high desert in Oregon. That's what I do with it. I figured I had to figure out something.
You've had such a fascinating history and going to Egypt. I mean, come on. Egypt is my dream, too. Maybe not in the same way, but I want to go down the river and see what it was like Cleopatra time.
Oh, well, you know, we did that in the tour thing with my grandpa.
Oh.
I think that's called a felucca or something like that.
Uh-huh.
So that was pretty fun. And I've been to several other places, like the Egypt or Greece, Mexico, Guatemala, Jamaica, Belize, and they all have to have some kind of connection with archaeology or the pyramids or, you know, ancient aliens kind of stuff, because I just love it.
Well, there are pyramids, unbelievable pyramids here in the United States that are buried,
yeah,
that they're just now finding. I mean, Ohio. Who would think that Ohio had a pyramid underground?
They actually have that snake kind of effigy that you can't see. It's like the Nazca lines, where you have to get way up to be able to see that snake. Really interesting stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. One of my favorite places was Lake Winnemucca. It's on the Indian Reservation near Nevada, near Paiute and Winnemucca Lake. And at that time, that was all water area. And they had mammoth petroglyphs there.
Oh.
I have some pictures with me standing next to them. And I was talking earlier about how the patterns are similar in different areas.
Yeah.
Winnemucca has the same type of patterns in their petroglyphs as some places in Ireland. It's amazing. Even in Labrador, San Ignacio, which is in Mexico, not too far from all pretty popular tourist areas down there, they have a beach that is, you know, it's not like a sandy beach, but part of it's sandy, and then you get to it has something to do with volcanoes again. You get these volcanic rocks. There must be 400 or 500 of them with different petroglyphs all over. And there was no one there when we went there. I actually took my son there with me. That's another funny story. Because I couldn't speak Spanish very well then. I'm trying to work on Spanish. I've done, 200 days worth of Spanish daily. And there was a toll road. So we rented a car. There's a toll road. You pretty much go out in the middle of nowhere. And I had the map to where this was. And they had all these petroglyphs all over the place. There was probably maybe two people there. And they were people watching the place. So it was amazing.
Oh, my gosh. I have a funny little story. I own property with my son up in the Sequoia where Paiutes were. It's like north of Bakersfield. And it's high up in the mountains where there's a lake called Lake Isabella. And I own property where the Paiutes actually had their burial grounds. And
cool.
And then just below me with the neighbor, he has the Paiute sweat stones with...
Lodge?
Yeah, it was a sweat lodge, yeah. So, and I remember I was digging up during the winter, it started, the spring started, and the water was rushing down the mountain. I lived right in the mountain, and the water would go through, and it was where the burial grounds were, and some bones were being exposed. So I went over there, and I was digging. I didn't realize they were bones right away, so I started digging, and then I went to bed that night, and owls were going nuts all night long. The next morning, I buried up those burial grounds, made an edge so that the water wouldn't go over those areas, and I never heard the owls again. Weird.
Well, you were visited then by the spirits.
I think so. You know, I'm like you. I'm an explorer, but I have great respect for culture. And that's a culture I didn't want to mess with. So how do we get a hold of you?
Well, if you've got a case that you need to report, if this has perked your interest, you can go to MUFOM.com, which is the main site in Irvine, and put in a case. And if you've got a case in Washington, it'll come up to our group here at the Washington chapter. And I am the webmaster for the Washington chapter. Do a few blogs and help with the Facebook. And that webmaster site where you can get tickets to some of our speakers on Zoom. And our next one, Selma Sedek, who was one of the children over in Africa that was visited by aliens.
Oh,
and
that's
so
right.
She's going to tell her story. But that address is WAMUFON.org. So WAMUFON.org.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, I saw that. Those are all the children that saw a UFO, and actually the aliens came out of the ship and were in their presence.
Yeah, and they drew pictures, and they were all the same. And
yeah,
wow.
It's fascinating. I can't wait for that. Yeah, people who want to get tickets should go definitely wamufon.org. Thank you so much. Really.
If you want to report or just chat about other things, you could send me a note at paranormalwire@gmail.com.
So paranormalwire@gmail.com to get a hold of Kathleen.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. This has been great. Really.
I know. It's been so fun.
Well, that'll do it for this episode of Strange Harbor. If you'd like to know more about Kathleen Wire, read the latest Sasquatch sighting reports, UFO reports. If you want to contact us, get a Strange Harbor t-shirt, or just yell at us for being tinfoil hat wearing whack jobs, just log on to strangeharbor.net.
You're listening to Strange Harbor, ghosts, UFOs, aliens, Sasquatch, all things strange. Online at strangeharbor.net. Strange Harbor, be strange.